Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Conejo Podcast. It is a nice, cool evening today. And today we have somebody that I have my whole body checked every year, like I know you do, Michelle. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important. And so today we have somebody that's going to tell you all about some incredible stuff and incredible advancements and things that he has in his practice. We have Dr. Gene Rubenstein on the line. Can you hear us, Gene?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start with, and I'm not going to, I'd rather hear it from you instead of me summarizing it. A lot of times I do, but you have a really incredible, rich background of how you, what you've done and where you came from through, you know, undergrad and getting your medical degree all the way through your residency and things, and all the teaching and stuff that you do. I'd like to start with that a little bit, if we can hear a little bit of your backstory, if you don't mind.
Well, I'm a local boy from the Conejo Valley. You know, I grew up in Agoura, and I went to Agoura High, and then afterwards I went to UCLA, and UCLA undergraduate in biology. And after that, I went on to a career in medicine at Boston University Medical School. So I moved out to Boston, and then while in Boston, I also did a fellowship at Harvard in lasers. And then I did my residency program at UC Irvine Medical Center. I know that you went to UC Irvine yourself.
Yeah, a little shout out from both of us.
Go Anteaters.
Yeah, great place. Lived right there on the lake.
Oh, wonderful. Nice. You know, I remember back in those days, as a segue real quick, back in the days of living, I was undergrad. You obviously had a lot busier schedule than I did. And so, I mean, I was living keg to keg in the fraternity in Balboa Island. And I'll never forget it. It's a gorgeous place to live. I loved it down there.
It was great, and it was a great education. We had a wonderful residency program that gave me a chance to see a lot of different types of patients in a lot of different settings, and also a chance to work at the Beckman Laser Center, which did a lot of laser research, which I later on used in my own practice.
Gotcha. And in Harvard, when did Harvard, when you went there to work with some laser technology, was that when you were at Boston?
Yeah, when I was in Boston at Boston University, I took a year and I did a research fellowship at the Wellman Laser Center, which is considered to be the premier laser center in the world. A lot of the newest technologies like Fraxel came out of that. And it was a real privilege. I was working specifically on imaging of skin, three-dimensional imaging, and also different types of laser technologies.
Wow, neat. Neat. That also takes me back to the day when I was looking at colleges and I thought I was an MIT kind of guy, but I ended up not being that with a 3-4 coming out of high school. Well, interesting. And tell me this also, how long is residency typically?
Well, we do our internship for a year. I did my internship actually at Kaiser at Sunset. So that was an internal medicine internship and then 3 years of dermatology. And during that 3 years of dermatology, we do surgery. We also do dermatopathology. We also do the medical dermatology and then some cosmetic dermatology as well.
Wow, interesting. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And then after your residency at UCI, did you go immediately into private practice?
Yeah, I immediately went into private practice. I started in the Valley. So initially I started in Encino and then quickly moved to Studio City, where I currently have one of my locations. You know, and it was a matter of building the practice. It was just seeing patients and then getting referrals. Word of mouth is the key. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm lucky enough to have a lot of word of mouth in the community.
Right, because I know I talk to a lot of doctors and starting their own private practices has its challenges, I'm assuming, right? Is there any, when was the time? I think you started in about 2003, is that right?
Yeah, I started in 2003. That was the challenge was that there were a lot of new technologies coming out at the same time. And at the same time, there was a push toward sort of computerization, and at the same time the insurance situation was changing, so all these things were going on, and it was a challenging time to get started, of course, but I think I had some good mentors, and I had a very good office manager, my wife actually, who is a great help to me in starting the practice as well.
That's great. And it almost it's kind of like you almost have to be, especially starting out, you got to start out being your own business advisor to yourself and businessman, and you also got to be a doctor, right, by the way, right? I mean, so it begins.
So I was lucky enough to have had actually a MBA. So I do have an MBA from Pepperdine University. And the MBA, you know, was important in kind of giving me the focus on business as well. I mean, I consider myself to be primarily a physician, but I don't think you can run a physician's office efficiently without knowing something about business.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. That's fantastic.
Wow, where'd you squeeze the MBA in?
It was before medical school.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, there you go.
All right, great. And then when did you then decide that, when was the date or what went through your mind also when you decided to expand into your Simi Valley location?
Well, I think that I did see a need. I had a lot of patients coming out to my practice in Studio City from Simi Valley and from the Conejo Valley. And, they kept asking me, when are you going to open up out there? And so, I know the area really well. I remember Simi Valley even growing up. But at the time, Simi Valley was pretty small. And I didn't realize that it was as populated as it was and that there was such a need for a dermatologist out there until I came out there and investigated. And then I found a great location, and it was a win-win for everybody. It's a population that's, I think, really, really needs dermatology because of the preponderance of skin cancer in the area. A lot of people coming from California, a lot of people who grew up in California having had sun exposure, like me growing up at Zuma Beach.
Oh, yeah, and we're the baby oil. As a right. Suntan lotion group, right?
Suntan lotion generation, right.
Yeah.
So the suntan, the baby oil generation. And I think that, a lot of, Caucasian people as well who, really are prone to sun damage as well. Yeah.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you're filling that need out there. Do you have any plans for some further expansion as time goes on?
Well, I'm gonna concentrate on the two locations for now. But yeah, I think eventually I can see myself opening up some more offices. Yeah.
Good for you. Now, tell us a little bit for a second before we get into some other stuff about you do some resident teaching as well, don't you?
That's right. Yeah, I teach the residents at UCLA. So I go out to the VA Medical Center in Wadsworth, mm-hmm. at the Wadsworth VA, in West LA, mm-hmm. and I teach the dermatology residents through the UCLA Dermatology residency program.
That's great.
So it's an extremely rewarding thing to do. I mean, I just volunteer there as faculty, but I think the wonderful thing is to see these incredibly smart people who were able to get into the UCLA dermatology residency, which is not easy to do. But at the same time, me having an ability to teach them, and then conversely, they having an ability to teach me a lot of the time.
Interesting. And do you also do work at SC, I saw, and maybe Stanford? Have you done that?
That's right. I don't play any favorites, even though I went to UCLA.
Right.
I have USC residents, family practice residents coming in to my office to do a rotation with me. And I think it's so important for family practice to get a view into dermatology, to really try to understand how important the skin is, mm-hmm. and how important it is to diagnose skin diseases, in patients. So a lot of the time we hear about primary care doctors, they kind of skimp over the skin. They don't really look very carefully. But I think more and more the trend is for primary care doctors to be more careful with skin exams and then to refer appropriately to dermatology as well.
Right.
And as far as the Stanford resident, the Stanford people are PAs, so physician assistants from Stanford who come also to rotate with me. And I think it's another trend. We're seeing a lot more physician assistants getting into dermatology. I myself have two physician assistants and also a nurse practitioner who were instrumental in my practice. We call them mid-level providers. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are extremely well qualified. And, they're qualified to do most things that a physician can do, including surgery and including writing prescriptions. So I feel great teaching the PAs as well.
That's great. And your confidence level sounds like it's pretty strong for the PAs in that level.
Yes, absolutely. I think that with proper training, they can be excellent and an excellent tool to use in dermatology.
That's great. All right, so let me ask you a little bit more about your practice and the advancements in dermatology, because, again, it was looking and doing some research on your practice, and it looks like you really cover the gamut. You have a multitude of technologies that I've never seen before, and so I know it's probably difficult to talk about in 25 to 30 minutes here, but what is your what's your overall thought on the technology that you bring to your practice and the kind of advancements that are going on right now in dermatology? I know it's a very broad question, but it deserves maybe a broad answer.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it is a tremendously broad question, but I think to make it more concise, we have to think of all these advancements as being tools in our toolbox. Really, the way that I approach every single advancement is to use it appropriately for the right type of patient. So to give you an example, let's say lasers. You know, there's so many different types of lasers, including ablative lasers, lasers that are resurfacing lasers, lasers that are non-resurfacing, lasers for redness, for brown spots, etc. And each patient has to have their own type of regimen. Each patient has to have their own treatment plan. So as my, you know, my mentor at Wellman said, you know, Rox Anderson, who was the inventor of the Fraxel, he always said, a tool with a fool with a tool is just a fool. So he was, his point was, you know, hey, you got a lot of tools in your toolbox, but make sure you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Don't just perform it just because you can. Don't perform this technology. And that's one of the problems I see out there is when a new technology comes out, all of a sudden it's being used left and right. And really the key is to learn the niche for that technology, the type of patient selection, the type of person that needs it. And so I think that's the main thing. When people come to my practice, a lot of the time they understand the expertise I have and the wide range of technologies I can use on them. And so they trust me to choose the right technology for them.
That's interesting. Yeah, that it wasn't even going there. I mean, it's interesting to hear that you, I mean, it is. It's almost like, you have to be skilled in the thing you're getting. You didn't just buy it from somebody for $50,000 and you're just going for it.
Exactly. It's not a shiny new toy. You have to figure out when to use it appropriately.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, exactly. So you have to go back to the physics. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing. You have to go back to the physics. What are we targeting with this laser? If it's a laser, what's the wavelength of the laser? What are we targeting? What exactly are we looking for in the skin to target within the skin? And what are we trying to achieve with that laser? So that's the main, you know, the main question I ask myself every time I do a patient consultation.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, I usually, if I ever go to the dermatologist, I don't go as often as I should, but if I go to the dermatologist and they give me a body check and they find a bunch of stuff, you know, usually I end up with something like I usually don't get consults like that. I get, you know, here's a can of really freezing stuff. Hold on, it's going to sting a minute. Or I get a knife with a couple stitches and the scar looks terrible for years to come. It sounds like, I mean, you're a whole nother level of practice. It sounds to me just straight up in the first, 15 minutes of speaking with you, where it is a whole kind of, you know, process of the person. You know, we have this thing here. It looks suspect. I'm not just going to take it out. We have these options. Maybe you're a candidate for this or this technology or that. It sounds, does that sound about right?
It sounds right. I mean, still, you know, I still use the can, you know, I'm a can user.
Sure.
For sure.
Sometimes the can is like everybody
else. It's a great tool. You know, it's so good. Sometimes people come to me and they say, can you laser this? And I tell them, no, this isn't something I would laser. I would freeze this off. So it's another tool in the toolbox. So it's not like I'm, against the old technologies, but I think that they can be quite useful. Mm-hmm. I think you have to divide the patients into sort of cosmetic and medical patients. And within the field of dermatology, oftentimes there's a gray area, you know. So there are people who are coming in for skin exams to make sure that they don't have skin cancer, but at the same time, they might have something that's bothering them, you know, from a cosmetic perspective as well. Mm-hmm. So we see that a lot, and I'm a very serious, you know, medical dermatologist. I do skin exams. I definitely biopsy. I definitely do Mohs surgery as well, which is an important type of surgery for skin cancer. But at the same time, you know, within my practice, we have the options of looking at other things as well if we want to do that.
Now, what are kind of the three most common things that you see in your practice from day to day, something beyond just a skin check? What do you normally see so our folks out here kind of know, at least in California, know what's kind of seen a lot, for lack of a better word?
I think the three most popular, the three most common things in dermatology we see is, one, we see acne, okay? And acne is a huge field, obviously. It's a huge diagnosis. Within that, we have teenage acne, we have adult acne, we have rosacea, and all of the gamuts of that. So we have a number of treatments that we can offer patients, including medical treatments like medicines, topical treatments, laser treatments, peels, all kinds of things. So that's one group of patients that's definitely out there. Another group of patients is, especially in the wintertime we see this, is psoriasis patients. You know, psoriasis is one of the most common diseases out there, and it's heartbreaking to see someone who can be covered with lesions of psoriasis and yet had not received a lot of treatments. And I'm proud that I'm an extremely medically oriented dermatologist and that I use all the treatments available, including the biologic agents, light therapy, all kinds of things that are out there that I think have brought amazing results for psoriasis like never before. You know, I mean, what else is there? The skin exams that you're talking about, so people with moles, when they come in with moles or skin cancers, I think that's another very, very common thing we see. So we talk about the ABCDs of melanoma with people. We look at their skin. Sometimes I'll find, you know, things like basal cells, which are the most common cancers in the United States. I don't know if you were aware of that. But the most common cancer in the United States is actually a basal cell.
Is it over other cells like lung cancer or another?
Over, yes, it's more common than lung cancer.
Wow.
We're talking about 5 million cases of basal cell per year, which dwarfs lung cancer, really. Now, the thing about basal cells is that basal cells are not the types of skin cancers that will kill you or will spread in the body, typically. But, you know, still, they can cause a lot of dysfunction, a lot of problems for the person, a lot of disfigurement, I should say, for the person.
Wow.
So we do remove them with Mohs surgery most of the time. Squamous cell carcinomas, melanomas, so these are the skin cancers. So those are probably the three main things we see is acne, psoriasis, and then the skin cancers.
Gotcha. And let me ask you about psoriasis really quick, because it's kind of near and dear to my heart. Let me start with this. Is it a genetic issue? Has it been shown to be genetic?
Yes, it's been shown to be genetic. So psoriasis is definitely a genetic predisposition. We've seen that patients who have both parents with psoriasis are extremely likely to have psoriasis. And then patients with one parent who has psoriasis have about a 25% chance of having psoriasis. So there's definitely a genetic predisposition, but then there's something else that we're not finding yet. The cause of it may be antigenic. So that means something that you encounter in your body at any time in your life that causes an overactive immune response that actually attacks the skin and causes the plaques of psoriasis.
Oh, interesting. Because my father, he may get, if he's listening to this, he might get a little angry with me, but
sorry,
so
Dad.
Be it. He suffered his whole life with psoriasis, still does. You know, sometimes if he's having kind of a rougher time, I mean, it's lesions, I call it lesions, but it's a tough thing to deal with. And, you know, he's kind of relegated himself to, you know, I think he used to put this tar type substance on it, and he's relegated something else. And I just don't know. I think he feels like there's not a solution out there for him, you know?
I think maybe he needs to see Dr. Rubenstein.
I usually tell my patients with psoriasis that they don't need to have psoriasis. They don't need to live with it because we do have treatments, and there's probably no reason that any patient with psoriasis needs to have psoriasis nowadays.
Mm.
You know,
wow.
And psoriasis is really near and dear to my heart as well. And especially, I could tell you that I had an experience where I was participating in a type of experiment where psoriasis plaques were applied to me personally. So I don't have psoriasis, but the psoriasis plaques were applied by a makeup artist who was one of the top makeup artists in Hollywood. He did Chewbacca and all of that stuff.
Mm.
So they put these plaques of psoriasis on me, and then I went out to public places, and then they filmed the whole experience.
Oh, wow.
And there were actors there that I didn't realize were actually actors. But what happened was they kind of showed their disgust at my lesions, you know. So I knew what it was like for psoriasis patients to feel the way that they do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're in a pool and then other people tell you that, hey, you're infectious, or you're in a restaurant and you're at an all-you-can-eat buffet, and then people tell you you should really not be here because you have these lesions and all of that stuff. So I think that's the main thing to take away from having psoriasis. It is not infectious, but a lot of people believe that it is, and it's very, very troubling for patients.
Yeah, no doubt.
Wow.
You know, I grew up watching it, and it's you know, I think he's just kind of gotten used to it, to be honest with you. But there are solutions out there that I think he and a lot of people like that don't know about. You know,
absolutely.
Let me ask you an odd question. I was watching one of your YouTube videos, and you know, coming from me, it might be kind of odd, but your skin looks unbelievable.
Thank you for that compliment. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I would love to know what you use.
What do you do? Do you have your own personal regimen that you do for your own skin?
Well, certainly I have to use sunscreen every day, and I use a great sunscreen called Total Defense. And that sunscreen, it actually blocks infrared light as well as ultraviolet light. So it's a new product that's available through Skin Medica and through our office. So that's one thing that I do. The other thing is there's a incredible cream which is called TNS Essential Serum. It contains growth factors. It contains antioxidants like your vitamin C, vitamin E, ferulic acid. It contains peptides which actually make your skin and collagen grow better. And it also contains retinoids like retinol. So I think that that's another thing that I use on a daily basis that I think makes my skin look better. I mean, the other thing is I noticed for some time that patients who walked into my office who had beautiful skin, I asked them, what are you doing? And of course, besides saying that they don't smoke or drink most of the time, they did tell me that they avoid meat products, you know, so that was a real revelation to me. And as I did more research, I realized that most likely I should get away from the meat products. And so at this point, I primarily have a plant-based diet.
Oh, interesting. You're saying meat, like red meat diets?
Red meat. I mean, I avoid all meats, you know, in my own diet.
Really?
You know, I think that a lot of people...
Turkey?
Right. Like, a lot of people still eat chicken and fish, but, you know, I avoid all meats myself.
Huh.
So, you know, I found that past the age of 50, I'm 51. I had my physical, and it was a great physical, the best I had in a long time. So I think that it's working. For me, it's working, and for a lot of people, it works, and it's pretty easy to do in Southern California.
Now, here's a question that I get. It's a leading question now. You led me into it, which is, have you found or is there studies that do find for sure that, you know, things that diet affects the skin? Like when I was a kid and I had acne, they always said sugars and fats and chocolates, right, and stuff like that. Is there anything to that?
Okay, so the thing is that there was a landmark study in 1968, right, that showed that chocolate does not cause acne. The problem was this, that the way the study was designed, the two groups were broken up into groups that received a candy bar with chocolate and a candy bar without chocolate. They both had the same amount of acne, but guess what the confounding variable was? The sugar.
Sugar.
So it was sugar. So that was not known, and for a long time we were telling our patients that, hey, you know, the diet doesn't really affect acne. I could remember until about 10 years ago, we used to tell patients that. And even up until 5 years ago, there wasn't a lot of evidence that actually food can affect acne. But now we see that it can. Primarily, we see that milk products can affect acne, especially low-fat milk. So that was a study that was done over 10 years ago. So I do tell my patients with acne that. The second thing is, high glycemic index foods. So glycemic index foods, high glycemic index foods that include, for example, white bread, rice, things like potatoes, pasta, those types of things, they can actually affect acne. And that's been shown in double-blinded studies recently. It's been shown in controlled studies that people with high glycemic index diets actually have higher amounts of acne than low glycemic index diets.
Wow.
And then finally, we can extrapolate to sugars. Now, we can say that somebody who eats a lot of sugar, they have a high level of insulin. Insulin is produced when you ingest sugar and there's a high amount of blood sugar in the blood. So because of that, insulin is produced. Now, insulin can then cause insulin growth factor to be produced, which increases the production of oil in the skin. So because of that, because of the production of oil, we can have increased acne.
So there you go, Michelle.
Wow. I've never had a problem with acne.
No, you haven't.
Sugar. That's another story.
Yeah, but then we'll kind of dovetail into what we were talking about before we got on with you is about wrinkles.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's my question is, you know, I use a cream, I use sunscreen, I do all that, but you know, I have friends who do Botox every 2 months, and I know they say there's nothing wrong with it. It just freaks me out injecting something every, you know, 2 months. What is your feeling on that, as well as other fillers? I know they've come up with new stuff, and I keep reading about other things. What do you say?
Well, this is what I think. First of all, it's every 3 to 4 months for Botox. Second of all, for a lot of the fillers, it's actually about 6 to 9 months, and now the newer fillers are sometimes a year or up to 2 years. So definitely it's not something that is done as often as people think a lot of the time. The next thing is, what are wrinkles? And, you know, we have to look at wrinkles in the same way that we have to look at medical patients. There are different types of wrinkles, different types of patients that have wrinkles, and what causes the wrinkles in the first place. So if you look at the upper face, a lot of the time the upper face has to do with mimetic lines. That means lines that are created by movement. And those types of lines can improve by relaxing the muscle. And the best relaxer of muscle that we have is definitely Botox or Dysport, you know, the other sort of competitor to Botox that's very similar. Mm-hmm. But what that does is it relaxes the muscle, prevents the movement, and thus prevents the lines from being formed in the first place. So in some ways, it can be reverse. You can reverse lines. And another way, you can actually prevent lines by preventing too much movement. I don't look at this as paralysis. I look at it as relaxation. So that's the way I approach it. That's the way I tell patients. I want them to still be able to move, mm-hmm. but just to be relaxed in the movements.
I see.
And I've had, you know, both men and women who've had Botox. And for men, a lot of the time, they don't want to look angry. You know, they have these two lines between their eyes and they look angry mm-hmm. all the time, but they're not. They want to look like they feel. They feel happy and they look angry, so they don't want to look like.
Right.
Interesting. And okay, you provide all that stuff in your you do Botox in your offices, correct?
Absolutely. I do Botox. I do the fillers, all of the gamut of fillers from Restylane to Juvederm to Sculptra, and all of the fillers that are available.
And how do you decide which filler to use versus Botox? Just you have to see a person's skin, the extent of the wrinkle, or how deep the line is? Is that how the decision's made?
Yeah. The decision is made like that. So sometimes we look at someone and we notice that they have a volume issue. So for example, someone has lost a lot of volume over time. And because of the loss of volume, they have increased lines on their face because of the volume. Other people, they just have a lot of sun damage, or they have damage due to smoking of their superficial skin, so they need resurfacing. There's nothing they can do with fillers because there's too many deep lines. So really, laser resurfacing is the way to go, which is going to give you a new layer of skin that's going to grow in mm-hmm. and cover the old skin. For fillers, we're talking about going into specific lines. And usually we're looking at fillers below the eyes. So, for example, the nasolabial folds, the areas around the marionette lines, we call them. So the areas around the chin. Mm-hmm. So for those areas, we use other types of fillers like Restylane and Juvederm. And those fillers oftentimes actually promote the growth of collagen. And that's what the most amazing thing is. I just saw a patient today who came back, and she said that she'd already not had fillers for about a year. And she was amazed at how long it lasted. Now, the thing is that the reason why it lasts so long is because of the promotion of growth of collagen. So when we put a filler in, like Juvederm, into the nasolabial fold, it causes new collagen to actually be formed, and that is a more permanent result. Even when the filler goes away, we have a more permanent result.
I see. Oh, that's so interesting. So you need either less over time or less frequent over time.
Exactly. And the same with Botox. I think when we do Botox in a scheduled way, let's say, every 3 to 4 months, eventually the muscles become more relaxed overall, you have fewer lines, and you need less frequent visits.
I see. Oh, very cool.
Oh, very interesting. All right, so there's hope for you.
Yeah.
I'm just trying.
You're being mean to me.
Oh, I can see you're very beautiful. Stop.
She's gorgeous. She is gorgeous.
Yeah.
She always makes fun of me because my forehead is just smooth as a baby's butt.
It's so annoying. He has not one line on his forehead, and I do.
Well, this has been a masterclass in dermatology.
I love it.
This has been really educational, Dr. Rubenstein, and I want to, not to toot your horn for you, but I've known a lot of dermatologists and as close friends. Just from our quick discussion here for half an hour, you're a whole nother level of practice. It's a whole person practice with, the diagnosis that works for the person with massive skill behind the tool. And I really appreciate you sharing it all today. I know people are going to find it very useful. What's the best way that people can get in touch with you at your office, one of the two offices, either in Studio City or CIMI, to learn more about it or make an appointment?
Well, the best way is log on to our website, laskinmd.com. Mm-hmm. And, our office number in CIMI is 805-522-3300. And the office number in Studio City is 818-505-9300.
Super. And I know you have some YouTube videos and stuff that I was having some fun with the other day that folks can find you on, also really educational. Well, I really appreciate the time tonight. It was really nice getting to know you and learning all about your practice and all the stuff that you're doing over there. It's great stuff. So thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jay and Michelle. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It was our pleasure. Really. Thank you.
Take care of yourself. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Good night.
Bye-bye.